Welcome to the Red Caps Podcast, a podcast where we dip our caps into the blood of our listeners and we ramble on about old school games. In today's episode, we are doing the final interview of 2022. We are bringing in Isaac Williams from Mouse Ritter, and we're going to sit down and have a chat. As you know, no mortal can win a red cap. So as always, I hope you can sit back, listen, and enjoy. It was a lot of fun to sit down and talk with Isaac, pick his brain a little bit about Mouse Ritter, a game I've fallen in love with. I think it's fantastic. And I hope as you guys listen to this, it convinces you even more so to go pick up a physical copy of this game. You can get it for free. We'll discuss that during the interview, but go and get the physical copy of it. It's beautiful. It's fun. And share it with young ones in your life, especially this time of year. But without any more preamble, let's send it over to the interview. Ladies and gentlemen, I am joined by Isaac Williams, best known for Mouse Ritter, a game that kind of really brought me into the odd sphere of games and made me start looking at them. So, Isaac, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. Yeah, I've heard that from a few people that Mouse Ritter was their introduction to the into the odd sphere, which is a little bit weird for me, but kind of cool.
So as folks can hear from the accent, you're down in Australia. It's early morning for you.
I am. Yeah. And I mean it's mid morning now, so I can't complain too much.
so we'll give you a pass if anything comes if I ask anything that makes you have to pause for a few minutes. You're actually the second person this week that I've interviewed from Australia. I was speaking with Steve of Low Fantasy Gaming. He's also down there. I think he's close to Sydney. I've gotten I asked him, I'll ask you the same question because for you it's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You have the lottery numbers, or is there any real world breaking news I need to know about before
I haven't looked at the news yet, so I couldn't let you know, unfortunately.
Mouse Ritter, where does the name come from? I assume the mouse comes from a graphic novel, but I don't know where Ritter came from.
I was like, you know, playing around with ideas, and I think my design process is very like chaotic. I think I kind of spent a lot of time jumping back in between graphic design and writing and drawing, just to find the ideas. I think they come best when they're all combined in a big mush. I think I was like looking at Knave at the time and loved the Black Ritter font that Knave used for its title. And was like, oh yeah, I want that kind of black letter, kind of slightly gothic style for it. And then was just playing around with words that kind of felt right. I think Mouse was obviously inspired by the Art Spiegelman graphic novels. And then you know, Mouse Ritter, Mouse Knight felt good. Brought in some of my German heritage, made my Oma happy.
Which at the end of the day, that's all that matters, right?
Yeah.
So
I think the answer is it looked good, looked cool, sounded good.
It does. It actually rolls off the tongue really well. A lot of German words for English speakers may not be as easy to pronounce at times, but this one, you don't even really think of it as it has that obvious German influence, but it could roll off your tongue just as easy as anything else. So
I am committing the sin as a non German speaker using a foreign word in a way which may be inappropriate or may be a word that just doesn't make any sense in German. So I apologize to any Germans who may have seen the word and been offended. But it has been translated into German now. So and I didn't hear any complaints from the publisher. So
good stuff. You put out the game under the brand of Losing Games. Where does that come
from? I think it's a little bit ironic. I think that role-playing games, I think, are most fun when you play them to lose. And I don't know if it's like the best name for a game company. It's not the most inspiring name, but I think it sums up my philosophy a lot of what I look for in a role-playing game is one that's fun to lose.
Yeah, there's a computer game that I did an episode on ages and ages ago, and I was liking it to role-playing games in the way that it was designed and the philosophy behind it. And it's called RimWorld. I'm not sure if you've ever played the game before, but it's a game where you don't really care if you win or lose. In fact, the losing is probably almost more fun because you get a really interesting story out of losing. And it's seeing how disastrous everything can go wrong.
I think Dwarf Fortress, which is just gotten its official release this week, I think is very similar in that it is a game where it's about losing.
RimWorld is about directly inspired by the Dwarf Fortress. It's almost in many ways the same game, just RimWorld set in space and Dwarf Fortress.
I guess there's more air pressurization situations that can happen in that case.
So Mouse Ritter feels incredibly polished. I know it's gone through a couple of revisions, but were there other games before Mouse Ritter that people should know your name from?
Not really. I mean, Mouse Ritter is my first like published role-playing game. I spent a lot of time writing things and throwing them away. And I think that's probably where the polishing comes from is that I, you know, it takes me a very long time to write anything because a lot of time goes into things that no one ever sees. And you know, I only ever release the things that I'm actually really happy with.
Well, you picked a good one to use as your first one, because you may have a hard time following up on it. It's not good, to be honest.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
I like the fact that it's so for folks who don't know Mouse Ritter, I kind of opened this whole thing assuming people would know, but for people who don't know what Mouse Ritter is, it's a role playing game. The subtitle kind of says everything. It's swords and whiskers, and you play as small mice going on an adventure, very similar to if you were a fan of Mouse Guard or Redwall or I've got the Mice and Mystics board game here. If you're familiar with any of those products, it's kind of that aesthetic, more with an OSR feel. Is that fair?
Yeah. Mice and Mystics is probably the most direct inspiration for Mouse Ritter. Like Mouse Ritter kind of grew out of my home game, where we were playing a game of Mice and Mystics. And enjoying it, but I think it kind of, you know, we kind of played it out, and at that point I was like, yeah, I kind of prefer to be playing Dungeons & Dragons, but we were enjoying the cute mice, and my friends were enjoying pretending to be little vulnerable creatures, I kind of took into the odd rule book and wrote some new background tables and started playing. And then all of the other rules kind of just grew organically, I guess, out of what felt natural for that home game.
So you not only designed this, but you did all the illustrations in it as well, which are really, really cool. How is losing games a one person operation, or do you have other folks as well?
Yeah, losing games is just me. Yeah, I mean, I'm working with Andre from Games Omnivorous to actually bring the product to life. So Mouse Ritter originally was it was my home game, and then I kind of like wrote up a little rule book for my players, kind of you thought, oh yeah, this is pretty good, we're having fun with this, and so polished it up into a little 24 page zine, which I put online, and I think Andre from Games Omnivorous saw that and loved it, and he really pushed for it to be something more than just a than just a, you know, a 24 page little black and white photocopied zine. So I think he had the vision to make it into what it is, into the kind of actual quite polished product that it is, with the box set and all of that.
Yeah, the fact that it comes in a box set and there's so many tangible, tactile things you can use with the game. And even so, I had originally played the free PDF that was available for to download. Mm-hmm. And I played that with my son, and he really enjoyed it. So I went looking for the box set, and it was hard to find. I couldn't find it anywhere until after I had purchased the book. So I managed to find the book alone. And uh-huh. So I've got that here. Nice. And it's fantastic. And then, like, the day after I found the book, there's a local company here that was selling the box sets. I'm like, okay, well, I'll probably have to pick up the box set here soon too. But the book, for those who haven't seen it, is really, really interesting. The eye-catching thing that I'm sure that you get asked about all the time is the cover of the book is the trunk of a tree, and there's a hole and you can see the mouse on the inside. When you open up the cover, there's a larger scene. My son went bonkers when he saw that. He thought that was great. He's never seen a book with a hole through the cover like that before. where did the idea of that come from? I know there's an older book that it was an actual mouse hole at a wall.
So that was the first printing of the book, which was the mouse hole in the wall. And then for the Kickstarter edition, where we kind of wanted to change the cover a little bit and made it a hole in the tree, which corresponds with the illustration on the front of the box as well. I think that, like, that I've got to credit Andre from Games and Nivoris with that as well. Like, he's a product tactile product genius, I think. Like, he really is able to think of great ideas for how to make, like, physical products that are really awesome to look at and awesome to hold. I think it is a really nice touch. Like, it feels like I think, like, the inspiration for the book was when we were talking about expanding it out into a hardcover, you know, into a box set. The inspiration for the book was me looking at like little golden books and wanting to have something that felt like that, that felt like that polished that polished feel that those little golden books have, and the kind of children's book feel. And, you know, like doing fun, like, you know, cutouts and things like that is such, like, a children's book thing.
Yeah, I didn't think of that until you just mentioned it. But yeah, with the size of the book and how the page count, it does kind of have that small, like, I've got so many of those upstairs in the bookshelf up there. I know exactly what you're talking about. Was there any more of, like, a logistical issue? Thing to solve with the hole in the cover? Was that more difficult to get made, or?
Oh yeah, I'm sure it was. Yeah, but Andre's up for a challenge. He's always up for creating some kind of weird product, and then finding the people who can make it for him.
So we were saying that the you've had the box set, and that Andre's great with physical things. Some of the rules in the game really bring in the physical side of stuff, mainly the inventory system that's there. And for those who don't know, your character sheet has a slot-based, almost video gamey like inventory system, where you may have to kind of Tetris items around a little bit to make everything fit. But the box set comes with, like, little cardboard chits for it, which I thought was just a really neat touch of taking away that the mundane of just writing down things and not actually thinking about them after. Like, you can forget that you have stuff written down, but you won't forget about these little chits that on a very limited supply basis. So,
yeah.
Was that how you were playing it when you're playing it with your home group? Were you guys doing that as well, like pieces of paper, or how did
you? We had, like, little cutouts, little cards. And that I think grew from, I love forcing my players into tricky situations, and I guess that kind of comes back to the losing game's name. in that I want to force my players into tricky situations where they have to make hard choices, and maybe they'll win or maybe they'll lose. So like the physical inventory system was basically a way to make that kind of tricky inventory management stuff like fun in a way, even though I'm forcing you to make horrible decisions. you've got these as well as your items that you're carrying around, and they have these like annoying Tetris shapes. Like you can't wield a bow while you're wielding heavy armor, because then you've got nowhere to put your quiver, because the heavy armor takes up all of your slots on your body, and your bow takes up all the slots in your paws. In addition to all of that, you've also got conditions which are like negative effects which apply to your character. So if you get injured, or if you get tired, or if you try to cast a spell and things go wrong and you get drained, then those also are little chits that you put on your character sheet, and just, you know, as you delve deeper into the adventure, things just get harder for you, because your inventory starts to fill up with these horrible red chits, and you've got to make that choice: do I push on, or do I head back and rest? So that combination of things, I think, like, makes that inventory management is not something that players usually want to deal with. Like, usually you write things down and then you ignore the any kind of weight or whatever. But I think that kind of combination of things makes it into a really interesting challenge, and where the game doesn't really have like character classes or abilities or things like that. So I think like the inventory management is the core of the game.
Yeah, having the you see a lot of like somebody takes an injury or a condition or something along those lines, and they're like, okay, well, I've got to drop this. So do you have room to take this? And there's you have that management game going on between all the players as they're trying to figure out how to do things. Like in a lot of ways, like for me, I love resource management in my RPGs, whether it be inventory or time or risk management. Just having that extra pressure, because having that pressure makes decisions, and decisions are what makes the game, right? So I really enjoy that. I like that's how that's set up. And even the magic system kind of also is all about choice and whether you want to risk doing it or go wrong. Will I, if I do this, the quest I have to go on to recharge my spell, it could be a whole different thing as well. So there's a whole lot of meaningful choices that everybody has to make on some mundane things that they may do in other games.
Yeah. And I think like a lot of these are like, I think Mouse Ritter, it kind of grew out of my home game, and it is kind of a combination of homebrew rules that I've just kind of picked together from things that I've just like enjoyed playing. So the magic system is ripped off, shamelessly stolen from the Goblin Punch blog. And the inventory system, I think, where I originally saw that idea on the Last Grass Grimoire blog as well. So I can't really claim, the core of the rules are from Into the Odd, so I can't really claim credit for any of this. I think it's more just that I've kind of pieced it all together in a way that I personally find pleasing.
Right. At the end of the day, it's everybody's standing on the shoulders of everybody else. And so exactly. if where you're at by the end of that is someplace that everybody enjoys, you still get to take a bow. I mean, you still got it up there. So, speaking of taking a bow, when I was speaking with Chris and Yohai and Mouse Ritter's come up, everybody's praising it. But I think by far, Mouse Ritter probably has way more third-party stuff that's been made for it than any of the other games in that sphere. I think I read that you posted something recently, like you're over 400 different independent people creating works for your game and
one of our real like community champions, Matthew Morris, he's like great at like just keeping a list of all of the community products. I try to keep track of them a bit, and on the Mouse Twitter website I highlight a lot of them as well. I think that because the setting is quite unique, I think that was one of the things I was quite worried about when we released Mouse Ritter, it does require a bit more work to find content for it. If you're playing Khan, for example, and that Yohai has designed that to be compatible with, you know, all of the OSR sphere. Yeah,
you can take a traditional fantasy game and you can play it with Karen and go that way.
Exactly. But with Mouse Ritter, you've got to put in a little bit more work, I think, to reskin an adventure. Like there's certainly adventures I've run, like classic D&D adventures that I've run with Mouse Ritter, and it's been fine. But you've got to do a little bit more work to, you know, make the goblin a rat or whatever, which you can mostly do on the fly, but it does take a little bit more work. And I think because of that, I think there's a bit more need for people to create content. And I think also Mouse Ritter just has a really great community of people around it, who are really excited to make things for it. I think like that's my favorite thing about Mouse Ritter is just seeing all of the excitement around it and the creativity around it, and watching people come up with new cool ideas that I've never thought of. I saw someone recently making an adventure that's set in a crashed plane populated with gremlins. That's a cool idea. I love that.
What I like about a lot of the third party stuff is there seems to be the community is kind of standardized on a format of how all these are going to be released, and they're in this like, you know, three panel fold out. You got some really capturing art generally on the beginning of it. Then you open it up, you've got your little hex map, and everything's all laid out around it. So even though it's a whole bunch of different people creating these products, it has a very standardized feel to how it's going about it. So you pick up one from, you know, person A, another one from person F, and it all feels like it fits together really well. I haven't looked. Did you guys provide like a template for this, or was it just kind of that's how it's naturally evolved?
Not really a template, but with the Kickstarter release of Mouse Ritter last year, we also worked with like 11 different creators to put together a bunch of different adventures, which we're calling The Estate. Which is a collection of 11 different adventures, which all follow that kind of same format, which is the format I kind of tried to I first used on Honey in the Rafters, which is the adventure that's included with the box set. I think it's just like how I like to process rules. I can't fit too many words in my brain at once. So I need things to be very, very short and very concise in order for me to just read it and, you know, my imagination can do the rest. We've got these 11 adventures in the box set, which all kind of follow that same format of, you know, a cover with some evocative art, then you open it up and you've got a cool map with a bunch of little keys around the side just to show you what the interesting things are. So I think like that's kind of, I guess that's the kind of official Mouse Ritter adventure format. That's the format I like to create and the format I like to read.
Yeah, if people haven't seen it, if you open up one of these adventures, if you're used to seeing things like one page dungeons from like the one page dungeon contests, or if you're used to seeing content coming out of from Necrotic Gnome and their control panel layouts, it gets that sort of a vibe of where you're getting very concise, short pieces of information displayed in a way that you could sit down at a table and you have everything you need in front of you and just go with it that way. So it's really, really nicely done in that way. Do you have like design pet peeves and design joys whenever you're going? Because you kind of have a unique skill set where you're across. So, you know, that some people are just writers, some people are just illustrators, some people are graphic designers. You've kind of got a well-rounded thing there. So if you had to like pick one thing where you're like, I love this type of design choice and I hate this kind of design choice, like, is there?
I think with adventure design, like lore dumps, I can't fit that in my brain. And I think correspondingly, that like kind of slotting in little bits of lore into room keys is, I guess that's kind of how I prefer to do it. It's maybe not, I think that there's probably a lot of DMs who really just want to know what the situation is and, have a good view of all the history of this location and have it all kind of written out. But personally, I kind of liked a little bit of sense of mystery in the adventure, even though, you know, it's like designed to be run at the table, right? So we try and present every little piece of information that you need, like when you need it and where you need it. But I think it's also good to like slot in a little bit of oh, that's a weird little detail. I wonder what that is. I think that my favorite one from the Estate Adventure is Giant Snake is in the Sewers. There's a lot of oblique references to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that we've kind of snuck in there. I enjoy people discovering those little jokes. I just can't read a lot of words. I think that's my personal limitation. I'm a slow reader. I'm a slow thinker. I just need things in concise little packets that I can understand and then move on.
Given some of the stuff you said here earlier, where you're saying that you like to give your players tough choices and while Mouse Ritter, some might write it off as being cutesy and it's little furry mice, you know, it can very much not just be a cutesy little mice game. What role-playing games were you playing before? Were you playing D&D games? If you had to go say, my fantasy RPG of choice is X, what would that be?
I think prior to Mouse Ritter, I was playing a lot of Into the Odd and a lot of Knave, which are both, you know, were like really quite concise rule sets. I think like that also comes back to my preferences of don't give me too much information to process. I think those are the main ones. I'll just be kind of playing either like homebrew constructions or like variations on OSR games. That's kind of, you know, I think over the last few years I've kind of taken a big deep dive into the OSR scene and found it really exciting to kind of rediscover Dungeons & Dragons as I played it when I got the red box from a friend of my dad when I was 9.
What's the role-playing scene like in Australia? Like, when you growing up, was there a large scene of it, or was it that you not, discovered not, via the internet I later mean, on? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in country Australia, so it was mostly me forcing my brothers into playing role-playing games with me, which they did begrudgingly. I think it wasn't really until I was an adult that I kind of, you know, just like made friends who I would play role playing games with. And so I didn't really have that kind of, I don't know, like Stranger Things kids in a basement playing Dungeons and Dragons experience that you, right. I guess you see a bit more in at least in American pop culture.
Right.
I don't know if that actually happens.
I'm sure it does. I'm not sure it's done quite as cleanly as it is on the TV show, but
yeah,
that's definitely a draw of it there at a certain point.
Mm.
I was thinking another one of the design choices that I have had to ask you about for Mouse Rider that I really, really like is the design around languages and how creatures of different species may or may not be able to talk to each other at all. And how that grew. Was that because, you know, language is always a thing in all fantasy RPGs, but it often gets hand waved away. Everybody and their dog speaks common, so it becomes a non-issue in a lot of games. Where did the idea for this come from, and how did you take the I want to have languages be a thing and come to this solution? Because this is so elegant that nobody can ever really debate you about it at the table. It's great.
The language's rule is based on etymology, basically, of your you can like mice can speak to other mice and other rodents, and then they can kind of communicate with other mammals, and then maybe a bee would be quite difficult to communicate with. You can't really speak bee, so it's based on the family tree of life. Where did it come from? I've got no idea, to be honest. I think I wanted to have some kind of language rule. I think I'm not really sure where it came from. But it just felt right of like what kind of captures this kind of fantasy creature vibe. Like, I think like Mouse Rider to me has never been really like, I mean, like, I guess like Redwall is obviously an inspiration, but it's never been a Redwall game to me where, you know, you've got all of these creatures, these different types of creatures talking to each other, having parties together, fighting each other. It's much more of like, it's like the, you know, the, I guess my conception of it, it's the real world with fantasy adventures happening underneath your feet. So like humans, I think, are never mentioned in the rule book intentionally because I kind of want to leave that as an empty space for GMs to fill in. But I guess the way I conceive of humans is that they're just living their normal lives. The humans are out there doing whatever humans do. The mice are having these kind of fantasy adventures underneath our feet that we'd never notice because we're too, you know, too worried about our human problems.
On my previous episode, on a recent episode, because I don't know what order all these will get released in, but on a recent episode, I was talking about, I had like just a bunch of random ideas I couldn't form a full episode about. But one of the random ideas was something I had read on Reddit where somebody had asked, you know, with in typical fantasy games, with dragons being so powerful, why don't they just take over the entire world? And there was an answer that I had read on there that I thought it was just so clever. And it was in their head, they already have. they look at humans living on their land the same way that we would look at mice living on ours. I'm not worried what they're doing. I'm more worried if there's other dragons that might come and try to take my land. And so the humans could have all their own little adventures and everything, when dragon doesn't care. It's you know, ancient.
They've got their own thing going on.
Yeah. So hearing you describe the humans kind of in that same vein makes a lot of sense. And there's for a game book that is relatively short, what's the page count of this? Like, it's like 40 some odd pages?
48 pages, I think. Maybe 46, so, without the covers.
So yeah, so for a book this small, it also contains, in a way, mass combat and domain building as well. which is kind of
snuck that in. Yep.
So we've got there's certain creatures. Probably the most obvious choice if you're having a game against mice is the cat. that an individual mouse has no chance. You can't, you're basically told, no, you need to go get a posse and come and come at this en masse, because otherwise, you know, you're cat food, which I thought was really an interesting choice. It forces people to go down that path, because often with, so I primarily play BX based D&D games. That's my kind of go-to. But there's a lot of times where unless you do this, where you're forcing it, there's a lot of players that'll just skip over the whole domain, also skip over the whole, you know, gathering a large number of people with them. The amount of times that I've had to remind people, you know, you might want to go get some retainers or something along those lines is ridiculous. But this, it straight up says, yeah, I know if you encounter these creatures, you can't do anything to them individually. You have to, you know, bring people. Was that trying to solve that exact problem of people not going in and building that up themselves, or did it just make more sense because of how the scale?
I think a bit of both. I really liked the like Into the Odd has mass combat rules, which Mouse Ritter has basically stolen. Right. So the warband rules are basically the same as the company rules from Into the Odd, which is that a company or a warband is basically just like you stat it like a character. It's got the same, all the same stats. It's got hit points. It's got damage. But then it's a you count that as a character at the warband scale. In quotations there. And so I really liked that really concise little rule set from Into the Odd of capturing mass combat, because it's just so easy to run. It's just like it's just exactly the same rules as you're already using. I think it made a lot of sense just to have those kind of I guess like the kind of boss encounters, really. They're creatures that you have to really prepare for, and I think like the combat in Mouse Ritter is all about preparation. Like, your characters are really squishy, and they will maintain their squishiness throughout their lives. You've got a really low level cap, and a really low hit point cap,
and everything hits.
Yep. Same as Into the Odd. You never roll to hit. You always just roll damage. And you kind of in narration, you can kind of treat a low damage roll as a close miss or just a nick on the fur, and a high damage roll as something a bit more deadly. I think the combat in Mouse Ritter is all about preparation. I tell the players, cheat, you know, or never fight fair.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the approach I take to combat in BX, is that if you're in a fair fight, you've already lost, because you're going to take as much damage as you're giving. You need to come at this and use, you know, your smarts as a player, and make sure your character has the best chance of survival.
Yeah, and so the warband rules are then just a way to push that requirement for preparation even further. Like, you've got to go out and find 20 fighting mice to come with you, and you've got to pay them a lot of money to do so, and then you've got to pay them even more money for them to keep fighting for you. And so you've got to already have done a lot of adventuring to get to that point. So if you want to take out a cat, you're going to have to do some serious work to do that. You're going to have to, you know, go find some lost treasure, drag it back to town, do it again, probably, because you haven't gotten quite enough yet. Then at that point you might, if you're lucky, have enough to rustle up a warband. And then at that point, now you've got 20 unruly mice you've got to deal with. and if you're going to be fighting unfair, which you should be, now you've got to get them into a situation where they can attack the cat in a way where the cat is not in a position where it can fight back as effectively as it normally would.
The oodles of money that you need to drag in Mouse Ritter is called pips.
Yeah.
What is a pip in your mind?
that's one of the most frequently asked questions. It's in the Mouse Ritters Discord FAQ, and the answer is figure it out yourself. It's up to you to decide. There's something small and portable that mice value.
Yeah, the best answer from an RPG is it's whatever is in your head. But yeah, in your game though, and seriously though, in your game, what do you, if for a game that has so much tactile things around inventory, what is the pip? How is the pip envisioned by you and your players in your game? Not that is a way that everybody should play.
I imagine them as little black stones carved with the portrait of the Mouse Queen.
Ah, very nice. Mm. When I first read it, we started going through. I considered using buttons, but then I looked down and went, "Oh yeah, that's the shield." but we've also kind of set on stones or on amber, an amberish type thing, for ours, and. Yeah, the adventures can be so big and small and all over the place. The first one I ran with my son, where we played the rule set fully, we went and stole a bottle of milk from a farmer who was milking a cow. We had to sneak into the barn and roll out this bottle of milk and stuff. It was good.
Awesome.
But what's next for Losing Games, and what I said earlier that it might be hard to follow this up. What would follow up, or is it even something that you want to, like, was this kind of like, oh, this is my RPG thing and I've got other stuff going on? Because I never asked what it is you do outside of this.
What's next? I've been working with Andre on from Games of Nivoris on their new product, which is the Hexcrawl Toolbox, which is a collection of 150 hexes, like hexagonal tiles.
I've seen that. Oh, sorry, I didn't put the name together. That's the actual physical, which makes sense because when I first saw that ages ago, I didn't have a chance to look deep into it. But when I first saw it, I thought of Mouse Ritter, just the way that the hexes looked, and yeah, that makes a lot of sense then. Yes.
Yeah, so I've been working with Andre on that. He's put out two products previously, the Undying Sands and Bottled Sea, which are kind of, you know, a smallish collection of illustrated hexes with a corresponding set of tables and adventure seeds and things like that. We've been working on the Hexcrawl Toolbox, which is a really big expansion on that, which is it's like 150 hexes and a whole lot of tables and procedures for running hex crawls, which I think it's kind of designed to be an introduction to hex crawls in a lot of ways, in that it gives you, like, you know, here's some basic rules to run a hex crawl if you've never done it before, and a bunch of support in order to do that. So yeah, that's been taking up my time this year, and then past that, I'm not really sure. I haven't really started on something yet. So we're doing a reprint of the Mouse Ritter box set in Q2 next year.
Okay.
So it will be more widely available then. Currently, it is quite unavailable, is my understanding.
Yeah, it's rare to find. I spent a bunch of time trying to find it, and it wasn't until I could find the book on its own, but the box set was very difficult to find.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll be printing a bunch of new copies of that, so that everyone who's heard about it but has not been able to get it can actually get it, which is good, because it's always a bit sad when people are scrounging around waiting on an announcement from a store that will never come.
But it's nice though that in the world of games, we live in a golden, platinum maybe age of gaming, where there's so much gaming choice. But it must give a good feeling, though, that you've got a game that is available for everybody for free. Everybody can go and grab the PDF for free. And it's the full game. They're not missing out on anything. But everybody wants the physical product. And you've got people clamoring for the physical item as well. So I think that says a lot about how much people really enjoy the game, that it's not just, oh, I downloaded a free PDF and then I go about my day. It's like, oh yeah, this PDF is awesome. Now and look at the cool book I want, and actually trying to get everything as well.
Yeah, that does feel really good. And yeah, that is a good point. The rule book is free. You can go download it right now. Please do. It's pay what you want, but please just take it for free if you want and just check it out, because I'm quite happy for the people to just be just enjoying it.
So a question I probably should have asked from the get-go, what background do you have in any of this? Are you a writer? Do you illustrate for other games, or like what is the day job that allowed you to get yourself through this at the beginning of it?
I'm a computer programmer by trade, very boring. But I think that does give me a kind of an analytical mindset that I apply to all of my problems. I try and present the rules in a very, I try and like analyze the problem of the rules and piece them together in a way that will make sense. And the same with design. I think I have a very I think it's a pretty boring style of design, but I think it's quite functional. I think I was a computer programmer in the longest COVID lockdown in the world. So I had a lot of spare time on my hand in the evenings to spend making a rule book. So it was actually a lot of people found COVID lockdown pretty boring. I was very busy, which I think got me through pretty nicely.
Yeah, I feel you on the COVID lockdown thing. Where I'm at here in Canada, we had in the area that I'm in, we were also locked down for a very long time, and restrictions much longer. Especially when we look down to our neighbors to the south and how there was just nothing for large periods of time. Here it was very much a different vibe. It is interesting those who were able to take it and become very productive in that time frame, and the rest of us, like myself, who sat on the sofa and just moped.
I think if you're the kind of person who's quite happy just sitting in a room writing away, ignoring all the outside world problems, that was pretty good.
So typically when we come to wrap up one of these episodes, one of the things I like to ask, so this will be the gotcha question that you were waiting for somebody to drop on you probably, is you've done, I'm assuming, interviews with folks before, you've done Q&As, you've had a bunch of people that have this game that come to you and ask you questions. And I assume whenever I approach you and went, hey, would you like to come on this podcast and have a chat with me? There might've been some thought in your head of, man, I really hope somebody asks me about this. What's a question to somebody that you wish people would ask you more about, or that haven't asked you at all, that you'd like to let people know about? Whether that's something about you or game design or Mouse Ritter or anything along those lines, what's something that I should have asked that we could have talked about that would have been really interesting?
Good question. Let's talk about I think one thing I like to talk about Mouse Ritter is the way it makes you see the world.
That's excellent.
Which I think is quite unique in Mouse Ritter. I think that's one of the things that makes me really enjoy DMing Mouse Ritter is designing an adventure which just gives you this kind of new way to look at the world, where you can look around your house, look around your yard, look around your local surroundings, go for a walk around the park, and just look at all the rocks and the branches and the fallen logs and imagine what adventures might be going on there.
Yeah, it's interesting, because if you live in a spot like, well, you're in Australia, I'm in Canada, we're not exactly countries that are known for grand castles and the scenes that you would normally see in a fantasy RPG, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas somebody who lives in in the countrysides in England might be going off for a stroll and come across a scene that would paint a fantasy RPG picture for them really well. I would assume, I've not been to Australia, but everything I've seen would lead me to believe that you're very much like myself. You've got a lot of nature around you, but it's not going to be in the same scenery. So
exactly.
Being able to use that and have that as inspiration is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think thinking of your adventure you played with your son, and you're like stealing a bottle of milk. Like, that's just like a really fun scenario that takes this really kind of quite mundane thing and turns it into this dramatic adventure.
Yeah, it was the thing that sold me on this game more than anything else. I mean, other than like, I was sold on it when I looked at it and read it and what have you, but when I played it, what sold me on it more than anything else, I think, was, so my son is a murder hobo in when we play RPG games. He just you see this, I hit it with my sword. Like, that's just kind of his default action on everything. Mm-hmm. With Mouse Ritter, it completely changed it for him instantly without any real prompting from me. And I don't know if it was the fact that he was a mouse and he changed his because he doesn't have the, he's young, he's only 7-8 years old here, so he doesn't have that background knowledge of fantasy novels and movies and all those tropes to lean back on, but he understands small creatures. And I don't know if it was just the fact that he could understand the small creature and go, oh, it's squishy, it might die, and I don't want the cute furry thing to die, or if I don't know exactly what it was that triggered for him, but yeah, he just completely, he changed his approach to everything. In the barn that we were stealing the milk from, there was a barn cat in there that was roaming around, so he was being very stealthy, trying to avoid it, and little things like that, that in other games that we've played, it just didn't. I want to go in. I want to hit the skeleton and stuff like that.
I think, yeah, I think the Mouse Ritter, like, I guess, setting does make you, it gets you into the mindset, I think, quite naturally, that of that low level D&D BX adventurer, where you're like I think like an experienced player of BX knows that your character is extremely squishy and that you need to be really careful. But it does take a bit of learning there, because I guess like if you've played 5e, or you've played, even you've learned from computer RPGs or whatever, you're used to being the hero, and I guess like Mouse Ritter says to you like straight off, you are small and you're extremely vulnerable, and I think it probably helps you get into that mindset as a player of I've got to be careful here.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you're given a weapon that's literally a needle or something, it disilludes you from being a superhero like some other modern games may make you believe you are. So if folks want to get Mouse Ritter either in digital form or in physical form, or if they want to follow you to see what cool new projects you will eventually come out with, where should they go to find all that information?
So you can just go to mouseritter.com. That's the best place to find Mouse Ritter. So you can grab the PDFs for free there, and a bunch of other resources. There's a bunch of third-party resources and the estate and Honey in the Rafters. So that's all available digitally. So we'll be releasing a reprint of the box set next year. The estate is still available if you want to get your hands on that. If you want to know more about me, I have a Twitter account which I post on sometimes, though less nowadays. I've started using Mastodon a little bit, and I'm doing a little bit of video game development over there. So
interesting. How have you found Mastodon thus far? I have my own little single person instance that I've got running. But how have you found the whole Fediverse Mastodon thing?
I've been enjoying it, surprisingly. Like, I think I'd miss the drama of Twitter, but it's good. It's good. I think it's nice to have a place to just talk about games or the other things I'm interested in with people who are interested in that stuff, and without the surrounding cancellation of the day at Twitter.
Yeah, without all the drama, it's nice.
Yeah.
The way I operate on Twitter, I have to use so much filtering just to make sure that I'm not getting sniped into into it. So I on any given point in time, it's like, yeah, no, all these sorts of topics I'm just muting, so I don't ever have to see them. And so for me, Twitter has never been real too bad anyhow, because I keep it very RPG focused. But I agree, though, the Mastodon has been a nice experience for me for the most part as well. One last question before we go. Computer game design programmer, grew up, you're roughly around the same age as I am, you've come up through that. Favorite video game or of the past, and video game recommendation for somebody who may
Video game of the past.
And I will judge harshly. I just won't stay with the judgment.
I'm terrible at favorites. I just can't pick any favorites.
Which game on your Steam library has an embarrassing amount of time clocked in on it?
That's my other thing about me, as I'm mostly a console gamer. So, okay. I think probably I've put the most time of my life into Slay the Spire. That's
I have it on like four different platforms. I know your feel.
Yeah. And then at the moment, what am I playing at the moment? Check out Untitled Goose Game. I mean, it's fun. It's funny. It's made in Melbourne, like Mouse Ritter. What more could you want?
That's an excellent suggestion. Anybody who has not seen Untitled Goose Game, my wife doesn't play a lot of video games at all. She's kind of she'll watch me play. She'll watch our son play, and she's got some like little mobile like town and farm management games she plays. But when I fired up Goose Game and played that a little bit with her, she actually asked for the controller to play through it. It's ridiculous. You act as a goose, causing chaos, and you know, trying to solve little puzzles and riddles by moving objects around and irritating humans,
harassing people. Yeah. I've had a lot of fun playing it two player with my 5-year-old niece.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on. I commend you again for the game, if for no other reason that it's brought my son and myself a bunch of joy. I know it's brought it for a bunch of other people too. So thank you very much for creating it and continuing to support it. And I hope the re-release of the box set goes amazingly well for you. And just thank you for coming on. It was a lot of fun chatting.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, it was a good chat. Very fun. Thanks.
All right, folks, I'm going to hand this to Future Me that's going to do any of the editing, and we'll chat again soon.
All right, folks, that's going to wrap up this episode of the Red Caps podcast and the podcast in general for 2022. We'll be back in 2023, and we'll see what new adventures come our way. I hope you enjoyed, you learned something, and that you are eager to come back for more. www.theredcaps.net has all the links to all the ways to contact me, and I would love to hear from you. Thank you very so much for listening. Remember, never let your caps dry out. Stay safe. Have fun. We'll talk again in 2023.